The views expressed on the following program are the views of the show's host and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station, their management, their donors, their underwriters, nor their seventh-born sons. Broadcasting from our secret underground studio in Olympia, Washington, it is time for the Thunderbolts. Yes, kids, there you were, enjoying your privileged white status, blissfully ignorant of the fact that your shoes were manufactured by a child slave, until one day, you turned on your radio, and you were struck by the Thunderbolt! Hello, Cascadia! It's time to wake up! Yes, you better grab that cup of coffee, because you are about to be struck by the thunderbolt of truth and justice. Here it comes. Yes, kids, the thunderbolt is your guide to activism in Thurston County. I have news. I have commentary, I have a calendar for activist-related events, kick-ass music, and dumb jokes! So Cascadia is off of the couch and into the streets! It's time to save civilization from fiery apocalypse! Though even the apocalypse is gonna have to wait until I have had a cup of coffee!
This is Britney Spears, and sometimes my friend can't come to the phone, and this is one of those times. So leave a message at the beep, and baby, they'll call you back one more time. And thanks for calling.
Hit me, baby, one more time.
Ah, you burned me!
Psychologist Timothy Leary, a smooth-talking 45-year-old, is regarded as the leading American LSD missionary, as well as the movement's most controversial figure. His early LSD experiments, where he used Harvard University undergraduates, resulted in his expulsion from the school's faculty. Recently, he was facing a jail sentence as lengthy as 30 years for transporting marijuana. Leary has appealed the verdict. While out on bail, his seductive talks on the virtues of LSD draw huge college audiences.
The LSD trip is a pilgrimage far out beyond your normal mind, into that risky and revelatory territory which has been explored for thousands of years by mystics and visionary philosophers. In the last year, we are told that perhaps a million Americans, most of them young people, have made the LSD experience part of their lives. Is this a social menace and a cause for alarm? I don't think so. I see nothing less and the speedy evolution of a new indigenous religion. The LSD religionist knows that the temple of worship is the human body, that the shrine must be located not in a public place, but in the privacy of your own home, and that the congregation cannot extend beyond your family and your closest friends. In 15 years, the high school and college students who are experimenting with LSD will be running many of our institutions and guiding public policy. Remember, the college students who are using LSD and marijuana today do not comprise a criminal class. They are not drug addicts seeking to escape. They are your best educated, your most creative, and your most courageous young people. And like it or not, they're going to build you a new civilization.
It would seem that in his novel, 1984, one of the only things that George Orwell got wrong was the exact year that Big Brother would materialize. And FYI, 1984 was originally entitled 1948. And so, just as with the central protagonist of the novel, we also do not know where we are in time. And as far as Big Brother goes, did you know that your new car is spying on you? Yes, kids. Most of the new cars that are manufactured these days regularly stream or batch upload location data and other telemetry to the car makers. These days, the car makers are literally tracking tens of millions of American cars. And what do they do with this gold mine of data? Mostly, they are warehousing it, thus leaving it vulnerable to leaks, breaches, search warrants, government hacking, and unethical employee snooping. And the car makers refuse to state why they are saving it or how they are using it. And they argue that they are allowed to do virtually anything they want with this data, thanks to the explicit consent, quote unquote, of the car owners, who after all did sign a lengthy contract at the time of purchase. This explicit consent is explicit even though this alleged consent was buried deep in a lengthy contract containing a vague and misleading clause that was buried deep within its exceedingly fine print. And meanwhile, over on the propaganda front, it turns out that Facebook, Google, and Twitter have all been screening and filtering extremist content, quote unquote, for years. Extremist as defined by whom, I would ask. Well, I would answer, all of the major social media platforms are considering any serious criticism of Zionism or of Israel to be extremist content. For instance, and they're removing such posts, and they're banning the people who post such posts. This has already happened to several respected journalists. For a while, the Googleplex tried flagging suspicious content, quote unquote, with a warning. but they quickly found out that such warnings merely made people even more interested in the post than they otherwise would have been. And so, our self-designated gatekeepers have recently confirmed to Congress that they are seriously stepping up their game and that they will now be targeting users who may be exposed to extremist terrorist content, and that their machines will attempt to redirect, quote unquote, their users toward positive and moderate posts, quote unquote. And they are not just tinkering with algorithms. They are going full out pure Orwellian. And they are actually creating counter speech, quote unquote, to marginalize what they are labeling to be extremist terrorist content. Ah, Georgie boy, what a prophet you were. And please note that I am quoting and unquoting all of these descriptions of their efforts. All of this Orwellian rhetoric is not mine. This is how they are themselves describing it. Evidently, they feel they don't even need to hide it anymore.
Sorrier than the Ritz Hotel, if your suite is bedeviled by lice. Sorrier than Exxon about the loss of Arctic sea ice. Sorrier than a schoolboy when his parents catch him swearing. Sorrier than Uber about the disruption caused by sharing. My sorrow is far deeper than a sinkhole in Arizona. My sorrow is way stronger than espresso brewed in Kona. I'm much sorrier than the Volkswagen guys when it was revealed they were cheating. I'm sorrier than even I am when my wife sees me overeating. I'm truly beset by the deepest regret that my generals made up a story. I know you're outraged and you can't be assuaged, but on the other hand, I'm sorry. Sorry about all the bloodshed and the patients burning in beds. I'm sorry the generals and colonels and sergeants just weren't using their heads. I'm sorry we had a hospital, if that's really what our targets were. But we're having an investigation, so I'm sorry I can't be sure. I'm sorry you think it's a war crime since I won a Nobel Peace Prize. I'm sorry to have to remind you, but we really are the good guys. I'm sorry you're leaving Kunduz. They could use some medical care. Although I'm sorry to say, most people who can are getting the hell out of there. It causes me pain that one of our planes should go back to the laboratory. So I hope you can see that if it's up to me, I'm sorry to tell you, I'm sorry.
Yes, Obama is sorry, but let's go back even further in time. I am now going to describe, for your edification and for your education, a phenomenon known as the Martha Mitchell effect. Now, Martha Mitchell was probably the most important actor in the whole Watergate scandal that you've likely never heard of. The Wikipedia entry on Watergate does not even mention her role in that. However, 3 years after he left the White House, Richard Nixon himself speculated that Watergate might possibly have never happened at all if not for Martha Mitchell.
There's always been a mystery about the drum.
Now, Martha Mitchell was the wife of John Mitchell. John Mitchell was not only Richard Nixon's attorney general, but Nixon called him his most trusted friend and advisor. Around the White House, John Mitchell was known as the deputy president. So John Mitchell ended up basically falling upon his own sword in an ultimately failed attempt to protect Richard Nixon. Now, Martha Mitchell was a bon vivant girl around town who is known for drinking a lot and for talking a lot. Now, this was problematic as Martha Mitchell also regularly spied upon her husband. She read his correspondence. She would eavesdrop upon official conversation. She would read his mail. And as a result, Martha Mitchell knew a lot of very clandestine stuff. In addition, Martha Mitchell was also known for brutal honesty and for not pulling punches over much of anything. She was known as the mouth of the South, in fact. Martha Mitchell would often get drunk and then call reporters late at night. A comedy show at the time gave her a mock award from AT&T for providing AT&T with so much business. Now, these habits definitely did not endear Martha Mitchell to Richard Nixon's people. And in fact, methods for muzzling Martha Mitchell were sometimes discussed during cabinet meetings. At first, Nixon's people tried to actually keep the Watergate thing a secret from Martha Mitchell. Now, when Watergate first broke, John Mitchell left his wife in California in order to go to Washington and deal with the situation. And in his absence, he assigned an FBI agent to watch over his wife. He ordered the agent to keep her away from newspapers or telephones because he knew that she knew too much. And he knew that she would likely start running her mouth about it. And indeed, Martha Mitchell tried to blow the whistle on the whole Watergate thing right out of the gate. Martha Mitchell did not think that a strong and noble man such as her husband should sacrifice himself for a weak and insecure little piece of crap such as Richard Nixon. Now, the effort to keep the Watergate scandal a secret from Martha Mitchell ultimately failed because Mrs. Mitchell personally knew James McCord. And so, when she saw McCord's picture on the front page of the newspaper as one of the Watergate burglars, and especially when she later heard her husband on the television machine denying that McCord had ever played a major role in the Nixon machine, when she knew damned well otherwise, Martha Mitchell cried foul. Or she tried to cry foul.
As he did so, her body slumped backwards.
That fixed expression.
At first, it was when he saw her eyes in her sleep, and she was already dead.
Oh, yes.
She was prevented from doing so by literally holding her prisoner in that motel room for several days. Eventually, she was held down.
Oh, yes. Called her name.
And tranquilized against her will.
And your body, Jazz.
At one point,
baby's gone blue.
The FBI agent literally ripped the phone out of the wall, even as Mrs. Mitchell was speaking with the legendary journalist Helen Thomas, who, upon hearing
who are we going to send flowers to?
Mrs. Mitchell yelling at someone
who are we going to send flowers to?
To get away from her, before hearing the line suddenly go dead, Helen Thomas then tried unsuccessfully to reestablish contact with Mrs. Mitchell for the next several days. When Martha Mitchell finally did start talking, the Nixon people then launched into a systematic campaign to discredit Martha Mitchell by branding her as a crazy drunk. And their effort largely succeeded. Later, they had Martha Mitchell legally declared to be mentally incompetent. So Martha Mitchell has now been largely forgotten. Her hometown did erect a monument to her, and the inscription says, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. After her death, one of the eulogies wrote that freedom and honesty meant more to her than protocol or appropriate behavior. However, while the general public has largely forgotten Martha Mitchell's name, it does still come up regularly in mental health circles. Psychiatrists will occasionally speak of cases wherein someone is professionally diagnosed as being paranoid or delusional because they are saying incredible things that are completely nuts. But then it turns out that what they had been saying was actually true. They had not been crazy after all. This phenomenon is known as the Martha Mitchell effect. We're going to take a quick station break now. We'll be back in just a minute. The views expressed on the Thunderbolt are my views and no one else's. Those views do not necessarily reflect the views of any of the stations that air the Thunderbolt, nor anybody that has anything to do with any of those stations. And now, back to the Thunderbolt. When I was a child, I specifically remember seeing one of those cheesy films that they used to show to school children in order to sell us on the wonders of modern technology. This film stated that in the future, machines would create a vast overabundance of wealth, and that we humans would then be free to pursue whatever pursuits that our hearts may wish to pursue. Well, half of that prediction has indeed come true. Thanks to our machines, we now have more wealth, both in real terms and on a per capita basis, and adjusted for inflation, than at any other time in all human history. The problem, of course, is that virtually all of that wealth is being funneled into the pockets of a small handful of people. And the only thing that is trickling down from them is tinted yellow and has a very foul odor. It would appear that I have rock steady job security as far as my unpaid work goes, as it does not appear that I am going to be running out of targets worthy of being thunderbolted anytime in the near future. However, rather than a constant non-stop torrent of sucky, icky, nasty badness, Yes, we here at the Thunderbolt also like to present solutions that work and throw those out into the ether and onto the airwaves and through those internet tubes, and then just hope they stick somewhere that the sun may someday shine. As longtime Thunderbolt enthusiasts know, and yes, I'm talking about both of you, I personally define capitalism as a parasite that consumes its host. Since I therefore do not consider capitalism to be a system under which I would like to live, then I have a direct interest in alternative methods of human interaction that do not involve mass murdering psychopaths stealing all of our money. Apologists for capitalism will point out that the capitalist system provides incentive for people to achieve greater things. However, as I continuously point out, one of the many problems with capitalism is that the wealth invariably accumulates into the hands of the most ruthless and unethical people. And the vast bulk of the population is left almost completely out of the economic loop. I would also point out that other cultures provide other methods of incentivizing their people that do not involve violently stealing other people's stuff. For instance, our local Puget Sound Native American tribes, i.e., the people that used to live around the Puget Sound before white people killed almost all of them, well, those folks engage in a practice known as potlatch, wherein someone gave away everything they owned. And the highest social status and the most of the political power was bestowed upon whoever gave away the most property. Another problem with capitalism is that it always requires a certain percentage of people to be unemployed. And under capitalism, if someone is unemployed, then they often have no income. And thus, they will often resort to crime, or to begging, or to drug dealing, or to various other unsavory activities in order to generate the income necessary for basic survival. The welfare state is one method that capitalists use to try to keep a lid on this, in that welfare provides a basic income for those who have no other income. The problem is that there is usually serious stigma attached to receiving these payments, and the payments are usually inadequate for basic survival. Another problem is that under capitalism, a large bulk of our population spends all of their time and all of their energy doing something that they hate to do and or doing something they don't care about doing, and they are doing all of this only to earn a bare minimum survival. If that, while their labor is making someone else very, very rich. Well, one method of dealing with this downside of capitalism would be to institute a universal basic income, or a UBI. A UBI would provide a mechanism wherein everyone is provided with a basic income that would be enough to provide for the basic necessities of life. And the thing about a UBI is that everyone would get one. There would be no means test, no restrictions, no qualifications. Homeless drug addicts would get one. And Bill Gates would get one. And speaking of Bill Gates, a UBI could easily be funded by a minimal tax upon capital gains, i.e. a relatively minor tax levied almost exclusively upon very rich people. Now, one advantage to a UBI would be that people would be much freer to do what they want to do rather than being forced by necessity to do something they don't want to do. And people who are doing what they want to do tend to be much more motivated, much happier, and much more productive than people who are doing something they hate to do and or something that they don't care about doing. So the state of Alaska has actually produced a prototype of a UBI. Back in the day, a bunch of oil was discovered on land that was owned by the state of Alaska. And what the state did was to charge royalties to drill for this oil. Then they invested these royalties into a fund. They hired a team to manage this fund and invest it in various enterprises. And then once a year, the state divides the profits from this fund amongst every man, woman, and child that legally lives in the state of Alaska. Now, one year, that royalty payment was $4,000 each, meaning that a family of four received a check for $16,000 from the state that year. And what this means is that Alaska is the only political jurisdiction on the entire planet that provides its citizens with a proto-universal income. And even though Alaska is pure red when it comes to politics, the best way for an Alaskan politician to end his career is to suggest eliminating this fund. Yes, kids, while there are rare exceptions overall, most people tend to do nasty things only because they have to do them, rather than because they want to do them. Another financial consideration is the fact that funding for social services could then be drastically cut back, and our social services bureaucracies would then be free to focus upon people that actually need help, rather than wasting their time dealing with fit and able people who simply want to raise their families but are unable to financially do so because a bunch of psychopathic hedge fund investors are stealing everything. Another thing about the UBI is that it would largely free us from the direct control of the machine, even as it simultaneously puts us at the machine's complete mercy. For this is the very thing. We are already dependent. Unless you want to go live in some cave and grow your own food and make your own clothes, then you are dependent upon whatever society you live in to provide you with your sustenance. However, if we can create a situation wherein we no longer need to fear losing our jobs or losing our careers simply for speaking out about whatever or for standing up for our rights, then the 0.1% would have that much less to hold over us. And I'm pretty sure that if we can break free of the economic chains in which we are currently bound, then I can guarantee you that people would thereafter be far less tolerant of the intolerable. Yes, even with a UBI, there would still be politicians and various other snaky people carrying out the orders of various factions of rich psychopaths. But the rest of us would then have much more time and much more ability to ride their asses about all that stuff than we do now. For you see, here is the thing. The machine is ethic neutral. The machine does not have morals, either good or bad. A machine will do whatever it is programmed to do. Therefore, the important equation here depends upon who is telling the machine what to do, and as far as that goes, the math is actually quite simple. It's 0.1% versus 99.9%. And I think that instituting a UBI would empower us overall. And I think that as long as we are aware and pay attention, that we could use the freedom and the economic power that a UBI would provide to us in order to demote the 0.1% from their current status of existential threat to the future of humanity itself, down to an annoyance that must be spanked every now and then in order to keep them in line. It is time to get to work now, kids. Yeah, so that's it for this week's news and commentary section. Olympia listeners will go to our local activist events calendar. And for you Seattle folks, I have some music to take you into the next hour. And I'm going to start off with a song that seems all too obvious for use in a program called The Thunderbolt. But for that very reason, it is a song that I have never before used in a Thunderbolt. Yep, it's time to get thunderstruck with AC/DC. Let's do it.
Thank you. that as a people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our names. Not in our name will you wage endless war. There can be no more deaths, no more transfusions of blood for oil. Not in our name will you invade countries, bomb civilians, kill more children, letting history take its course over the graves of the nameless. Not in our names will you erode the very freedoms you have claimed to fight for. Not by our hands will we supply weapons and funding for the annihilation of families on foreign soil. Not by our mouths will we let fear silence us. Not by our hearts will we allow whole peoples or countries to be deemed evil. Not by our will and not in our name. We pledge resistance. We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war or for their religion or ethnicity. We pledge to make common cause with the people of the world to bring about justice, freedom, and peace. Another world is possible, and we pledge to make it real.
That was Not In Our Name by DJ Spooky. And before that, of course, was Thunderstruck by AC/DC. That's all I've got for you this week. I hope you enjoyed yourself, and I hope you learned something, and I hope you'll tune in next week as well. And in the meanwhile, I have the bonus tip of the day for you. Let's get back to some universal basics. Peace. We'll see you next week. The Thunderbolt is a production of Dancing Angel Media, which is solely responsible for the content. Neither the stations that air the Thunderbolt, their sponsors, their members, their underwriters, nor anyone else that has much to do with anything else in any way, is responsible for the content of the Thunderbolt. Nor do they necessarily agree with the views expressed on the Thunderbolt. If you have any comments, or if you wish to express an opposing opinion, you should send an email to dana98501@gmail.com, and we will make arrangements. And I hope that you have a day. And a quick note here, the Thunderbolt is on Facebook, where you can find links to the show and to the show notes. Or you can go to radioforall.net. That's radio4all.net, where you can also find the show notes, as well as a year's worth of downloadable episodes of the Thunderbolt.
Thank you very much.